Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet.
Award-winning concert pianist Donna Storing with us, and she has been doing that. She's been a concert pianist since age 5 and ongoing tours worldwide. She's a vocal soloist, a composer, conductor, coach soloist for La Scala and Munich, and she is the founder and CEO of Global Music Media Content Company, and also the founder of the Global Hybrid Social Venture and Listen for Life. And let's say, Donna, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much. It's great to talk to you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, music is so critically important, and I really wonder how much the average person realizes how much of an impact music has. Now, stop me if I'm wrong. I'm not a musician, but Donna, the information I've garnered over the years is that, let's say when you're going to dance with somebody, that particular music gets you into a sway and gets you in a completely different emotional feel. Music is a vibration, and does it not have an effect on the vibration of your body?
Absolutely. No, you have all that right, and one of our three main goals and why I speak around the globe is to raise people's awareness of the tremendous impact and power that music has in every aspect of our lives. It's not just background noise. It's not just a soundtrack for our life. It is influencing directly how we experience and get through that life successfully.
You know, you watch a lot of these kids, and we're going to call it toxic music. You watch some of this stuff, and you watch the looks on their faces and the reactions, and it almost seems as if they, when the music stops, they take those feelings with them, and it has an effect on their normal everyday lives.
Oh, boy, does it. Yes. I collect stories around the globe, pro and, you know, positive stories and negative stories. That's what my upcoming book is about, is sharing those stories. And some of them are very sad because of the behavior changes in young people after listening to, you know, a few songs with, you know, the wrong lyrics on their way to school.
Yeah, and by the way, when we talk about the wrong lyrics, you know, the words are one thing, but it's that beat behind it, I think that's what makes the difference. You know, there were, I think Canada and we did here, there was, you know, subliminal advertising. You'd walk into a store and very quietly under the music, you would hear, you know, buy our bread, buy our this, buy our that. And people would automatically do that. It's the same kind of a message with music. Music is so captivating that during that period of time that you're listening, if you're into it, and especially if it's a real high, hot beat, it's hypnotizing.
Yes, and there have been many, many recent scientific studies, because we have many more capabilities now than we did even 20, 30 years ago with, you know, wiring electrodes and measuring neuron changes and all that. They can see why particular beats and length of time of having a particular beat go on make profound changes in our thinking and then our behavior.
Now, by the way, to bring somebody into a hypnotic state, there can be that continuous sound, that continuous beat, and that'll bring somebody into a very suggestive state. And if the words are right, you can get people to do anything that you want them to do. And I don't like saying it that way, but it's true. Look at the movements that have that music has been behind.
No, that's absolutely true, and it also depends on the speed of the beat. You can do things, you know, with a pulse that's about the rate of a resting pulse of a human being, and that can positively create relaxation, for example. You can create specific melodies where listening to that melody creates a particular mood or relaxation response. But at the same time, you can turn that around for the negative, and people deliberately do it, yeah.
Well, sure. I was doing yesterday, I was cleaning the windows in my car, and I was outside, and I've got a stereo in it, and I turned the music on, and I had a CD in there, and I happened to like the latest Rod Stewart kind of music. You know, he went back to, you know, some of the great show tunes, the great songs.
The American Songbook Series, yes.
Yes. And I'm out there and I'm listening, I'm singing along with it, you know, and I was thinking about that too. It put me into such a great mood that the reverse of that can also happen too. And I'm glad you've got your message out, because it's an extremely important message. You get young kids who do not understand the dynamic and the interaction and the communication in music, you got a problem out there.
We do, and it's increasing because each child is with their own iPod listening to things in isolation, so that parents or teachers are not aware of what they're listening to, and they think, oh, I see my kid home. He's safe. He's sitting on the couch. He's not anywhere causing trouble, and he's listening to things on his iPod. Yeah, well, you don't know exactly what the words are. And, of course, then you have the opposite problem, which is that with any child of any generation, if you tell them, do not do this, that's going to be the one thing they want to do. So we have to be able to come at it in a positive light and offer wonderful alternative listening experiences, especially for young people, but for all ages, and say, you know, try this. Here's something completely new and different. It's not the same old. And that's why Listen for Life has been creating programs and products such as Travels with Music, which is an online, you know, set of 300 music videos filmed around the world showing an experience or inducing an experience of instruments that young people normally never even come across, and they like discovering new things. So rather than saying to them, look, you should listen to what I listen to, we're giving them a whole new approach that they can try. So there are alternatives out there, but the three main messages that you know, my upcoming book is trying to get across is that, to recognize the power that music has in our lives, and it's incredibly important. Number two, to recognize that all music has a message in it, whether we are conscious of what we're taking in or not, because a lot of times young people just say, oh, I'm not listening to the words or the beat or the mood of the piece, but it goes in, and because it grows directly to our heart and bypasses our brain in a lot of cases, and that's what makes music so powerful. And the third thing is that we have to empower all people to understand that they can make a choice of what messages they take on board and what music that they listen to.
So in essence, what we're really saying is there's a tremendous amount of messages that we get through music, through our communication, and if we are not careful, the wrong kind of message can come out, and especially with the youngsters today, you know, they're so geared to doing and being what their friends are doing and being,
right,
that if a particular kind of music is there, they're impressionable, and that impressions can do one of two things: it can take them to a good place, or it can take them to a bad place.
That's correct. So, what we're trying to do to counter that, to create a positive alternative for that, is to first raise people's awareness about it, yes. And then secondly, we have programs, Listen for Life has programs that we bring into schools wherever we're asked around the country, to show kids, both in media examples, movies, multimedia examples, that of cases positive and negative and how it affected their peers and what were the consequences of that, so that they can see it and respond and talk about it. Thirdly, create programs that all people can do, either online from their home computer or, books about this topic, to get people aware one way or another that works best for them. So we're trying to hit from all angles.
Let me ask you this, and I think it's critical. The music message campaign in the elementary schools, when did that start, and how is that working? And then to back it up, what kind of a challenge are you coming up against, and who are creating the challenges?
Oh, what great questions. I started with Listen for Life. We exist to create projects, as we are requested to do, to address specific needs in specific locations. So that project came about maybe 2 years ago now, from a school principal in California who called us in and said, I am perceiving a real scary problem here that I think, from talking to my peers, is in all schools, at least in most parts of the country where you have any kind of gang influence in the city. And her problem was this. she's a very popular principal. She's a young woman, bilingual, and teaching at a, or being principal of a bilingual school. This little five-year-old girl runs up to her in the hallway and grabs her hand and is swinging her hand down, you know, skipping down the hallway before school starts in the morning. And she is singing a song at the top of her lungs, and she's very happy, and the principal's happy, until she really starts to listen to what the words are that this little five-year-old is singing. And she's singing in Spanish, and she said the words were the most violent, misogynist lyrics she had ever heard. Mm. And they were happened to be from a gang song. Nothing to do with any one particular, you know, ethnic group or race at all. It was just the way it was. And she just shuddered because she said this particular little girl could not memorize her ABCs yet. She was having real problems. But she'd obviously memorized every single lyric of this very long song and had no concept of what she was saying or singing. And so the principal called us in and said, can you come create a program in our school for all the students, K through 8, that will wake them up? Because obviously this little child has learned these words from her big brothers and sisters playing this music at home or in the car or wherever, and the parents are either oblivious or don't realize the consequences either. So she said, we need to teach the teachers and the parents and the kids in a way that the kids will accept. And so
We're starting to run out of time now. We're in a real sharp time constraint. Let me ask you this. Yeah. Two questions. One is, how can the average person help you with this? Because I think it's a phenomenal idea. And two, website that we can find you at.
Oh, thank you. The website is listenforlife.org. And that leads to all of our other programs. And the average person can help us by being a volunteer in one of our schools or projects anywhere in the country, by contacting us, offering to volunteer online, or by giving a donation to our projects to enable us to carry out our work in their own community or anywhere around the world. And they can also buy our products that we create to help the listeners.
Wonderful. And we can find all that on the website?
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Hey, Donna, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you for your time so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Good night.
Night.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Todd Reed with us has spent nearly 20 years observing and studying in human behavioral patterns in a variety of relationships, including friendship, dating, marriage. He's a two-time NBA television sportscaster of the year, a two-time NBA radio broadcaster of the year, and in 1996, he was chosen to carry the Olympic torch at the 6 Olympic Games held in the U.S. His latest book, Conversation is Sexy, is written to empower men and women to sharpen their communication skills and understand how each gender operates. Todd, can you hear us? Are you there? Todd, welcome to the show. Can you hear us? Maybe not. I can hear me. One of us can hear me. Don, Seth, I don't think he can hear us. We'll get you. Just stay with us. A little faith works. Okay, hi. Okay, Todd, you with us? Okay, not a problem. Not a problem. We'll talk about conversation. Conversation is absolutely so critical, because when it comes down to it, it's in the conversation that's going to make you or break you any way you look at it, whether it's a relationship from a man to a woman, a business relationship, or you're buying lemonade, or you're battling with the lemonistas out there trying to take over the world, but we know what to do with them. Todd, are you there yet? Todd's not here. Okay. Oh, Todd, did we get you?
Yes.
Oh, good, good. Thank you so much for being here. Did you hear the intro?
I heard the intro, and then it just went silent, and didn't hear anything from there. So I wanted to, I don't know what happened, but wanted to make sure that I got back in touch with you.
Oh, you're right here. Okay, let me do it this way, then we can go from here. His latest book, okay. Conversation is Sexy, was written to empower men and women to sharpen their communication skills and understand how each gender operates. And let us say, Todd Reed, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
And thank you. Todd, what was it about this particular subject in conversation that brought you to put this information to pen?
We just, you know, over the course of time and over the last many years, and personal experience, the combination of personal experiences and having the opportunity to help folks in committed relationships just find out and rediscover the fact that it can be fun, should be fun, and, you know, just really, you know, a movement on our part to help folks, you know, learn how to enjoy their committed relationship and on a more frequent basis, shall we say.
Now, by the way, can we define committed? You know, that word is so loose today. You know, a relationship 25, 30 years ago was different than a relationship is today. We've got, what, 50, 55% divorce rate, and it's growing, and there's so many single moms today that don't even think that marriage is even any way to go. So a relationship today has got to be something that's almost a learned skill. You don't just meet somebody, fall in love, and you're related. You've got to work at it.
There's absolutely no question about it, and you know, we tell people committed, obviously, you know, we're shooting still for, even in this modern day and age, we're shooting for monogamous and folks that have, you know, really decided that this is the person that they want to spend the rest of their life with and start a family or maybe not. Obviously, that's up to them as they make their path and make their way through, but obviously, you know, folks that have decided, fallen in love, and they really feel like this is the person and know that this is the person that they want to be with for the rest of their life. And to, you know, what we did with Conversation is Sexy is trying to educate them that it's not always an easy road. And you know that too well, Michael Ray, that, you know, that sometimes it does take work. And we talk about that being a four-letter word that folks shouldn't be afraid of, but that they should embrace. And with certain, you know, simple tools and techniques and things they can do on a regular basis, that the relationship can really be enjoyable.
Now, one of the words that you use, which is an operative word, the word is own. Own the relationship and work as a team. Too many people today, Todd, won't own the relationship. It's only good and as long as you're doing it the way I want to do it. And I've felt for years that a relationship is not 50-50. A relationship is 100-100. And for many people, that's very hard to get to.
I love how you say that. That's absolutely fantastic. In fact, I was having the conversation today with one of my clients, and we were talking about that very specific thing that, you know, we talk and have gone through all the different generations over the past 30, 40, 50 years, and they've all been named. And, you know, we've gone from the X generation to the Y generation to the me generation. And you know, so much in relationships, folks have a tendency to focus on how am I feeling? How does this affect me? You know, why aren't I getting what I want out of it? And part of the problem is we forget about the other person, or we don't necessarily take time to, you know, really focus on the other person, because the hardest thing to do sometimes in a relationship is to step outside and, as you pointed out and as we say in the book, own it, and the fact that, you know, maybe I need to extend myself to my spouse and my partner do something and really, you know, open the door of communication when maybe we've had some static, and to know that I can't just wait for them to do it. I need to take responsibility and take the first step, and that can be in so many different areas of the relationship. That's just one example.
I think one of the biggest problems, Todd, was probably within the last couple of years, there was an interview that I did, and the name of the book was The First Kiss Can Make or Break the Relationship, because men do not ask women how they like to be kissed right up front. I can't remember ever doing that. You know, we automatically assume that that's the way it is and that's it. But she got me to thinking about that, and wouldn't it be interesting in relationships? You meet somebody, and when you decide that you're going to get involved, you sit down one day and you say, what does love mean? You know, how do you receive love? And let's say, for instance, that me, it's a wink, a look, a tone of voice, expression, something, the way I show love. And I meet somebody, and the way she's learned to receive love is you buy her something. So we're going along for 2-3 years, and I'm winking, and I'm looking, and I'm doing everything I can to express how I feel. 2 years later, I walk in one day, she's all packed up. I said, where are you going? She said, well, I'm leaving. Why are you leaving? You don't love me. What do you mean I don't love me? You never show me. And I wonder, right. Yeah, very seriously, if you would ask that simple question, that basic question right up front, how many of these marriages wouldn't end?
I agree. And I think that it's so key and so critical in a relationship. And one of the things that we don't do enough of, because you know, for the folks that have been in long-term and committed relationships, and whether they've been successful or maybe not, early on we all remember that sort of honeymoon phase when we first get together and that process of falling in love. And we seem to go, you know, from that euphoric state, and we sort of bypass a real critical stage, and it's exactly what you talk about, where, you know, you go from just where the emotions are running rampant to saying, okay, now that we're starting to segue into a day-to-day lifestyle, and you're going to go to work and I'm going to go to work, what are the things that are really important to you? What do I need to do for you in order to really make you want to come home at the end of the day? And I think that those are conversations that a lot of folks aren't taught to have, because that really sets the foundation of the relationship, and important because it also lets both folks know, you know, I can express myself. I can say what's on my mind. I can share this, even if they're sensitive topics, and we as a couple can handle them. We're not just going to put it in the closet somewhere so that it jumps out at us 3 years later as a skeleton.
Yeah, it's also, too, one of your talking points, which I think it's brilliant, because it's called recognize the importance of scheduling periodic relationship checkups. I wonder how many, out of a million people, maybe two people might even think about that.
We get emails, you know, Michael Ray, from folks across the country and talking about that specific topic, how, you know, after having a chance and reading the book, that they've started doing that again. And it can be something as simple as, you know, going out for appetizers on a Friday or a Saturday night, or whenever your schedule, and we all have different schedules in our lives, but whenever it's available, just set aside some personal time to go out and to just connect with that person. And it can be done, you know, obviously a long period of time is nice, but it can be done in an hour or two, a half hour, just something where you have a chance to sit down in a quiet, not crazy environment, but a quiet environment, and just have some real heart-to-heart conversation and just reconnect and attach those emotions of love back to the relationship.
Now, by the way, one of the other things that you talk about, which I think would be a very interesting challenge to move through for a lot of people, using jealousy to your advantage.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, and folks experience it, men, women, we both, you know, both sexes obviously go through it, but, and obviously, I break it down a little bit or talk about the fact that there is obviously healthy jealousy. There can be unhealthy jealousy as well, and that's a different topic to be addressed. But, you know, being excited about the person that you're with and how beautiful they are and how they look, and if they've got a vivacious personality and other people are attracted to them, you know, that's a fantastic thing. And to be able to recognize that and embrace that in a relationship is just fantastic. And to really reinforce to the other person that, you know, that you are just so committed to them, and that they need to look at those traits and those qualities as real advantages to the relationship, and that you're just there. And jealousy is just one of the biggest wasted emotions, I think, that's out there. It causes more trouble in relationships, And folks, I think, often just don't know how quite know how to handle it.
One of the greatest examples I've heard about staying on track is most people drive down, quote unquote, the highway of life with their hands on the rearview mirror, and they get into a lot of accidents because they're looking backwards while they're steering ahead. And it's that simple shift of being able to drop your hands from the rearview mirror onto the steering wheel to get where you want to go. The mistakes of the past cloud the vision. It's the rearview mirror. Sometimes we look at somebody who smiles us at a certain way. There's a frown. Maybe there's a word that triggers something that happened in the past, and you have no idea that's connecting to what's going on now. You're in an argument or you're in a fight with somebody, and it has nothing to do with them or now, but it's what happened in the past. An unconscious activation of a memory triggers a response, and you got a battle going all night, and it had nothing to do with that person you're battling with.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt. We spend so much time, and that's why, you know, there's a couple things that we talk about and point out specifically, that as things happen, and you as an individual obviously have to take inventory of what's gone on in your past and the things that have that will allow you or trigger your sort of hot buttons or that you're sensitive to, and you need to make your partner and spouse aware of those, what they are. And trust that they're not going to use that at some point against you, but they're going to accept that. They're going to hold on to that, because there are those times where those things pop up, but you need to not pay attention or not dwell on those, and to be able to look exactly, like you said, take your hands off that rearview mirror, look forward, focus on the here and the now and what's going on. And if you do have an issue with something that's going on, address it and find a time that you can sit down and have a healthy conversation about it and come to a resolution. And the resolution obviously can mean multiple things, but have a resolution on the table so that you can then put it behind you, so that all of a sudden there's not so much of those different events and episodes that you talk about that are sitting in that rearview mirror. There's nothing back there. You're just driving straight ahead.
Yeah, and one of the things I know you talk about is learning to forgive, not necessarily forget. You know, there's this word that's very powerful in relationships and business and life, et cetera. You know, and that word effectively is purpose. And if your purpose is to remember everything that they ever did to you and pay back, you've got a major problem. And if you just take a simple shift in the way that you think and repurpose yourself, then all of a sudden everything can happen. It's the same thing, yet the outcome is completely different. And instead of forgiving and forgetting, it's called let it go flat. And if there's no, if it can't get to you, you've won.
One of the things we tell folks all the time, and when we chat with folks, and I truly believe this, and it's one of the cornerstones and foundations to what we do, is, you know, nobody wakes up in the morning with the thought that they're going to, and I truly believe this, it's the thought that they're going to really mess up somebody's day. You know, I'm sure you didn't wake up this morning, and I didn't wake up this morning going, you know, I'm really gonna mess with my spouse today and just mess their day up. And so, in the course of relationships, sometimes you're going to do things that you know irritate the other person. And when that happens, you need to go through the process of figuring out the behavior and what happened, and then you need to forgive, and you need to exactly let it go flat and come to a resolution, forgive. Now, and the forget part is, you know, you sort of tuck it away in the back of your mind, because we all know that patterns of behaviors can indicate some things, and we need to pay attention to those. But in a given individual isolated incident, you know, we need to forgive, let it go, and move on, because, again, we, you know, folks in committed relationships, you love each other. You didn't wake up in the morning and just go, you know, I'm going to mess your day up today.
I know some people who do that. Producers. Hey, Todd, we're just about running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at so we can buy the book and get more information?
Absolutely. Two ways to get it. More information on what we're doing is at Conversation, simple, at conversationissexy.com. The book's available there. It's also on Amazon.com for you if you wanted to find it there.
Dynamite. Hey, Todd Reed, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, good night.
Good night. Hugging you, miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only.
honey. You always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sky Storm's with us. He's the author of Get the Job You Really Want, What Works and How It Works and Why It Works. He's the author of the widely distributed and highly regarded Job Acquisition and Retention Skills Clinic entitled Survival in the World of Work, published and distributed by Ohio State University. Spent several years researching job acquisition and retention skills prior to his 27 years as a career education coordinator at a secondary level vocational technical school, where his primary responsibility was helping inexperienced young people move smoothly and successfully into the world of work. And he's worked with adults as well as helped them accomplish the same transition. And let us say sky high welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael Ray. It's nice to be with you. I couldn't believe that I did all those things that you read. That's wonderful.
I thought it was great. I was standing up through the whole thing.
So was I. Yeah, you know, that's really neat.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing, Sky, when you go back and look at everything that you've done, and then when somebody sums it up and you hear it, sometimes you have to sit back and say, did I do that?
I've had that same experience looking at some of the things that I wrote under assignment in college, and I say, wow, I must have been on fire when I wrote that. That's really good. That's impressive.
Now, by the way, the job market, in and of itself, the job market today is so completely different than the job market was, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. Today, you can apply for a job, and you got 10,000 people standing at the door applying for the same job. And it's very difficult for somebody to be an individual in today's marketplace without some kind of skill behind them or somebody looking over their shoulder to let them see what they don't see. Where was it for you when this first started for you as far as looking at the job market? What got you interested in it and caused you to put what you have to pen and help the people that you've helped?
Well, it was a variety of things. Actually, I had a health issue a year and a half ago, and I lost all four of my little businesses. And I was forced to take it easy, so I thought, well, I might as well put this down in writing. There are so many people that need this basic information, and they just don't have it. And if you look at this, the scope of this thing, I work mostly with inexperienced job seekers, and they can be of any age. They can be right out of high school at 17, or maybe they're 47 and they're in the same job that they got out of high school and plan to stay there the rest of their lives, and now they're downsized. The biggest difference there is they probably have a family by then, so there's some stress involved. But the process is pretty much unknown to either of these people. Frankly, it's amazing to me that we don't have a required course in high schools in this country, call it How to Get a Job 101 or something like that. But our schools are doing...
Yeah, let me hold you up. I want to go back for a moment. In high school, you triggered something in me. I remember when I went to high school 300 years ago, that they had wood shop, they had auto shop, they had all kinds of different shops to prepare the kids if they were not going to go out for ongoing and continuous education, to prepare the kids to get some kind of a job once they've got out of school. They don't have those things anymore. And it's really tied down to mostly technical things, and which puts everybody in the same kind of a category of looking for that particular job. And this preparation. By the way, I'm with you. It should start in junior high school and move all the way through so they have some kind of a handle when they get out, if they don't go on to college, or if they do, where to start once the education is stops, which it never stops. But the key here is, what do these youngsters look at today when they're getting out of school? And are they truly prepared? And are most adults prepared, if they've lost a job or they've been outsourced, to go out onto that market again and get what they want?
No, it's a whole different battle game right now. And it's a very challenging thing for someone who's never done it. It's challenging for those that have done it. If someone is right out of high school or right out of college, either way, with the education that they think they're going to need in the workplace, they're up against all these people that are on the street already who have the skills already in that field that they want to get into. Traditionally and historically, there has always been opening slots for college grads to move into in most of these skill areas that they study.
Sure.
That's not the case anymore. And so we have so many, I guess they're called boomerang kids, that when they get out of college, can't find what they were trained for, and they wind up living at home with mom and dad again. And some of those are going back into college to get an advanced degree. And I have serious misgivings about that kind of an effort. If before I get too opinionated, let's give you a chance to respond.
Okay. No, by the way, be opinionated, because it's your subject matter, and I wouldn't even want to stand toe-to-toe with you with it. But one of the things that I have seen effectively, you know, the question, that proverbial question comes out, what is it an employer is looking for? In my experience, that employer is looking for one thing and one thing only, that the ancillary help to increase that bottom line, period, end. And if you can show somebody that whatever it is that you do, whatever facet of that business that you're involved in, can increase that bottom line and help the income in some way, shape, or form, that's a real good way to get hired.
You're right on target. There's really just four things that most employers want to know about you. They want to know who you are, where you've worked, what have you done, and what can you do to help my company advance itself in the marketplace.
Absolutely.
So you're right on.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to tell you a story that you got to promise not to tell anybody. This is our secret.
Okay.
Okay, got it. Good. And the confidence is good. 20, 25 years ago, I ran into a real hard time money-wise, and I had to go out and get a job. And I didn't know what I was going to do, and there was this ad in the paper for a used car salesman. Don't tell anybody. There was this ad in the paper for a used car salesman. So I'm driving down the street, and my car, Sky was not me. The car turned into the lot, okay? So the car turns into the lot, and I get out of the car, and I walk in, and the owner happened to have been there. And he sat me down, and he said to me, this is the entire interview. He sat me down, and he said, what do you know about selling cars? And I said, what do I have to know about cars? I can sell anything. He said, when do you want to start?
That was it?
No. Okay, because it was bottom line. That's really what it was all about.
Well, the basics of that hasn't really changed. It's just that it's such a buyer's market right now that employers can be really picky. So what we have here now is, in addition to those hard skills, the mechanic, the machinist, or what have you, the soft skills have become the hard skills. And this is a whole new realm of things where the things that you bring you that are kind of like human nature to you. Are you honest? Do you get to work on time? Are you a hard worker? Can you follow directions? Can you make deadlines and things like that? Those soft skills have become very important, and as a matter of fact, they're taking precedence because everybody that comes through the door has the hard skills.
Scott, when one of the things also that's different today, in the old days, you went to work at 9 o'clock, you had a break or two, you went to lunch, and then you finished up at 5 or whatever. Today, you can sit out on the beach and get a suntan, and with your BlackBerry, do everything that somebody would have done years ago at the desk.
Yes. I have acquaintances that have spent the last 2.5 years sending out applications over the Internet. Hmm. What is that standard phrase about insanity? You know, something about doing the same thing over and over and somehow expecting different results. And the Internet has changed the whole game. Internet applications are successful somewhere between 7 and 10% of the time. Face-to-face interviews still work best. The challenge is, how do you get them? I address that in my book. It's quite a process, but it's easy to follow. We're in a position now where people need to do some networking. And I describe how to do it and why to do it that way and how it works.
Some of the magic, okay, in this, and absolutely networking is extremely important. The old days, it was 6 degrees of separation, and maybe you could run into 15, 20, 30, 50 people. You do it properly the way you're talking about, you're talking at tens of thousands of people that you'll connect with. But there's an old something. If a lot of these kids knew this, it would make the difference when they applied for anything that they would go for. Quick scenario. You want a hole in the wall at home. You're doing a project. So you go down to the hardware store to get a drill, which is going to make the hole. The question would be, I'm not asking you the question, but the question would be, what are you buying? Are you buying the drill or are you buying the hole? The kids that will be buying the drill are the ones who are not going to get the job. The ones who know it's what the drill can do for you, which happens to be the hole, which is what you're buying, are the kids that are going to get the job. It's not the position of the title of the job. It's what that title means to that owner, that person, or the person that's going to be responsible for hiring you. So a little bit of research to find out what kind of a place it is that you're dealing with, what is it that they really want, and quote unquote, and I'm not an expert in the field, it's just common sense for marketing, that you're a step ahead of the game, because it's not the drill, it's the hole that they're after. And 90% of the kids walk in there, they're selling themselves, but they're selling the drill.
Well, this goes back to our original statement when your show opened about getting some basics in high school. And kids really need it early. Most kids, at least when I look around, kids turn legal age 16 and they can work. A lot of them are just chomping at the bit for a job. They want their own money, and it's a good motivator. But they haven't been given any of the basics. I talk to some employers that say to me, these kids come in here acting like they're going to do me a favor if they're coming to work for me. Well, they wouldn't. That doesn't sell, of course, but they wouldn't have that attitude if they'd had somebody show them the ropes a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know what showing the ropes has to do? There's the C word. It's called consequence for your actions. When I was a kid and you did whatever you did, they brought you into the coach's office. You bent over and they put a phone book between your head and the wall, and you get a swat in the rear end. And if you jumped up, you got another one when the phone book would fall. You didn't want to go back in. You didn't bleed. There wasn't any counselors and there was no emotional upset. You didn't like it, so you did what you were supposed to do. My contention is the only thing a person is responsible for that goes to work for somebody is to do what the person's paying them says to do. As regard to the job. Yeah.
They also owe that employer their loyalty.
Yes.
I know lots of people that are unhappy with their jobs. And if they're going to complain about their jobs every time they get out of work, they need to stop taking that paycheck at the end of the week. It's just not right. So you can call it any way you want, but it's sort of like you need to prosper wherever you're planted. Right now is not a good time to be flexing your muscles with independence if you want to keep your job.
Oh, absolutely true. Again, it's called consequence. The other word is responsibility. Those kids that are responsible will get the jobs. And you said it all. The real questions, you know, are you going to be here on time? Are you going to do what you're supposed to do, et cetera, et cetera? Those are really what it comes down to. And one of the things I've seen, people walking in to apply for a job and the way that they're dressed, the way that they look, they don't care anymore.
Well, it's true. I've seen some people that look like they just crawled out from under a rock someplace, and they're wondering why they can't get hired. Well, obviously, they're not taking that whole thing seriously. They're walking down the street, they see a help wanted sign, and they drift in there no matter how they're dressed, and say, I'd like to fill out an application. His chances are nil. It just doesn't, it's not that casual anymore.
No. And one other thing, too, and we've got a couple of minutes to go before we're done. And it's something that you do talk about, and you have a great story that exemplifies it, and it's called transferable skills. I'm going to let you have the microphone. I think this is a critical point to get across.
Transferable skills, they can be extremely important right now when hard skills are there. Everybody's got them. But things like being able to make deadlines, and if you have any public speaking abilities, if you have organizational skills, managerial skills, do you have self-control? Are you detail-oriented? Are you good at communications? Writing skills, all these and more. I got a long list of them in my book, along with the character traits that are very helpful. These have nothing to do with their hard skills, but it has everything to do with appealing to the values of whom you're talking to. An interview is a very, very short period of time where you're trying to convince an absolute stranger to put you on their payroll. And the part of this that not too many people spend time on, but I do in my book, is the first 10 seconds when you are in that office for that interview. An experienced human resource person is so good at their job, they can tell in the first 10 seconds if they want you or not. That comes down to preparation, body language. When you walk in, you need to be on your best game. You don't get a second chance at a first impression.
Now, by the way, there's no question about that whatsoever. And some people just don't get this. We've got a word called entitlement running around today, and there are too many kids and adults locked into it, and they think they can do it their way. When someone's going to pay you, when you're on the opposite side of that paycheck, you're the one that's going to receive. You can't think like you. You have to think like the employer. You have to step outside of yourself, and it's very hard for so many people to get.
It is hard. I had a hard time with it when I was a kid. I used to think if I got my body there on time, I was fulfilling my obligations, no matter how tired I was. Well, that's not the case, obviously, and I had a very kind-hearted boss who straightened me out. I was probably 16 or 15 at the time. It was a great object lesson.
Sure.
Responsibility is key, and if you can show that with what you're doing, that goes a long way. When you're working, you never know who's watching. You just don't know. So you need to work just as well and just as hard when the boss is not right under your nose as you do when he's gone.
Sure.
So go ahead.
No, I said sure. I mean, no question about it. Sky, we're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Absolutely. It's skystorms.com. It's really simple. And if people who've been job hunting for a long time and are still adrift, go there. I have alternative approaches published there. Some of them might appeal to you. And please do make yourself at home on the website. I have all forms of electronic delivery, everything that there is, plus the paperback.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much, Sky, for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much, Michael Ray. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Good night.
Good night. Good night. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. We'll be right back.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms, because I want.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Susan Wade with us. She's the author of Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way. She is one of the founding grandmothers of the herbal renaissance. Her four previous bestsellers titles included New Menopausal Years, The Wise Woman Way, Breast Cancer, Breast Health, The Wise Woman Way, Healing Wise, The Second Wise Woman Herbal, and Wise Women Herbal for the Childbearing Years. She maintains an active worldwide teaching schedule. She offers correspondence courses, online education through the Wise Woman University, and shamanic apprenticeships. She has taught at the Yale Nurse Midwifery School, American College of Nurse Midwives, and we're going to go on and on with this because it's absolutely wonderful. Susan, welcome to the show.
Green blessings. I'm so happy to be with you this evening.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, when we deal with, let's use the word shamanic for a moment. We're dealing with very old school, basic healing. We're dealing with the things that happened before allopathic medicine, before chemicals, which everything that we have today is a derivative of those things that you talk about. So let's start from the very beginning. Susan, what was it that caught your eye that turned that light bulb on and said, this is the way, this is going to create some international global healing?
Oh, so many things. But, you know, I really think that you are so right. Shaman means woman with drum. It's a word from Siberia. And one of the things that I have found is around the world, in every indigenous culture, it is assumed that every woman is a shaman and every woman is a healer. And a man can be a healer or a shaman if he does one thing.
Which is?
He has to find his womb. He has to find his woman self.
Yeah.
Since there is a woman who lives in every man, because your chromosomes are XY. And so half of your chromosomal material is woman and half is man, whereas 100% of my chromosomal material is woman.
Okay, so you're, well,
you
okay,
had
wait,
it
let me
partly
get it right.
Right. He talks let about get... the anima and the importance of the man finding his female self in order to be whole. But then he tried to push it because he likes, you know, things to be neat, and he wanted women to have a male self, which it just isn't so. For women and men, the journey is exactly the same. Finding the powerful female self that lives inside. And so when I talk about the wise woman way, you notice it's not women or women's, it's woman, which is inclusive of man as well as woman.
No question about it. By the way, when you talk about shamanism and Kabbalah are very much akin to each other, because if you look at the basic teachings, you're going to find a lot of the same thing. But the one thing that I did not realize, I realized that there is femininity in men. There's that balance, that homeostasis between your male and your female self. But I didn't realize there wasn't the balance with women, if it's just women, as opposed to men, women. What happens
right
to that other side of you that you don't get to be able to relate to
that?
There
is no other side. I am whole unto myself as a woman. You know, balance is the step that immediately precedes death.
Okay, so all right.
We never want balance.
Yeah. All right, now, how does this...
We want dynamic disequilibrium.
Okay, but the homeostasis, okay. But how does this bring me to health?
How does this idea bring you to health? Well, you know, I talk about in my green book, Healing Wise, I talk about the three traditions of healing. the scientific tradition which measures and fixes us if we don't measure up. The heroic tradition, which most people consider alternative medicine, which tells us basically that we're a filthy bag of toxins and we have to clean up our act. And the wise woman tradition, which says you're already perfect exactly as you are. And through nourishing your unique individuality, we can help you to find greater perfection and greater wholeness.
By the way, I'm totally on board with that.
So the scientific tradition fixes, the heroic tradition cleanses, and the wise woman tradition nourishes wholeness.
Okay, but the nourishing of the wholeness, there are so many people that it's not that they don't understand it, they haven't been exposed to it. And Susan, if you're not exposed, you don't know.
Yes, and you know, that's one of the things that makes my books very unique. There are quite a few, let's face it, MDs and medical professionals out there who are writing books about health. And there's at least as many, if not more, writing books about alternative medicine. But what you will find in each one of my books is a complete coverage. So I talk about serenity medicine, also called do nothing. I talk about story medicine. I talk about mind medicine, energy medicine, homeopathy. I talk about lifestyle medicine, food, and exercise. And those four medicines build health all the time, as well as reverse disease process. And then I also talk about the whole range of alternative medicines available to us, including, of course, herbal medicine, which is my passion and my heart. I also talk about supplements and drugs, which can occasionally be useful for us. And, of course, surgery, break and enter, which, well, I'll tell you personally, I had a hernia repair, and I'm very glad that I could check into a clinic and have that done. So in offering all of these options in my books, I really do set the stage for nourishing wholeness. You know, when I first started studying herbal medicine in the 60s, it was kind of an us-against-them war. It was, as you said, allopathic medicine against alternative medicine. And I began to realize that really allopathy simply is a way of describing a way of treatment. And allopathy literally means that if you have a cough, I give you something that soothes your throat. Whereas homeopathic medicine, if you have a cough, I give you something that causes a cough. In homeopathy, like treats like. And in allopathy, different is the treatment. And so all herbalists are allopaths, chiropractors are allopaths. Most people that we would say are practicing alternative medicine are practicing allopathic medicine. And so I created a word that spoke from my heart, and that word was complementary medicine. That I didn't want a war. I wanted us all working together. Now that word has been superseded by a word even better, and that's integrative medicine. But what you find in my books is complementary integrative medicine. Whatever it is that you choose to do, you will find ways to protect yourself and keep yourself healthy.
Susan, I have found in my experience, and I'm not a clinician, but I found in my experience that no matter what you do, it's nothing. It's building the immune system. The immune system is the be-all, end-all. It's the immune system's job to protect and heal the body. And everything that you do is going to complement that immune system. I remember 13, 14 years ago, I had a debilitating illness, and they basically said I had maybe a year and a half to live. And I remember I had to get an operation. I'm sitting in the garage, and I'm on one of these exercycles, and I figure if I've got to get an operation, I'm going to be in the best physical condition that I could possibly be in. And I'm on that bike, and all of a sudden it hit me. I got my aha moment. And the aha moment, the epiphany, was this, that I made it okay to die. That didn't mean I wanted to die. I made it okay to die. And the minute that I made it okay to die, it took the pressure off. And all of that, the worry and the concern and the rest of it went away. And when that happened,
you stopped wanting to fix yourself. You stopped blaming yourself and thinking you'd done something wrong, and you moved into nourishing wholeness. And as soon as that happens, there is an aha, and there is this tremendous, almost like flush of energy into the immune system.
Now, by the way, for me, it wasn't blame. It was the minute the doctor said it, my first thing out of my mouth is, how do I fix it? And I think that's really where the key is. It's called, if you want to fix it, fix it. And I know that there are many people who have diseases, and it's their last year or so of life, and it's wonderful that for them because they've never gotten the attention that they've gotten through this period of time. And then what happens? They die. That's what they leave everybody. That's the legacy. But the point of contention is when you stop the worry about it, you stop the stress. And what you do is you kind of forget about behind you, and you don't worry about in front of you, and you pull it all together into one centeredness, and then the answers will come.
Yes.
Yeah.
I so completely agree with you. There's a couple of new things in Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way. I, of course, followed on and built from my previous books. New Menopausal Years has sold over 1 million copies and translated into a bunch of other languages. And that was the book immediately preceding this one. And the one before that, Breast Cancer Breast Health The Wise Woman Way. And both of those had just, you know, like a few stories and a couple of ways to make the information easily accessible. But in Down There, there's so much information that in every sub-chapter, there's a little help box that gives you the four or five remedies that I think are the most effective. It doesn't tell you anything about them. I mean, it's pretty kind of, it's very terse, as a matter of fact, and you have to go back then and read the text if you really want to find out more about why I'm saying those things. But like urinary tract infections, expect results in 3 to 4 hours. 1, drink lots of lemon water or cranberry juice. 2, take a dropper full of Uva Ursi, Echinacea, or Yarrow tincture hourly. 3, sit in a hot bath and relax.
Hey, by the way,
so
cranberry
there you have
juice.
It. 1, 2, 3, you have a urinary tract infection, you know what to do. And while you're sitting in the hot bath relaxing, you can read the rest of the stuff about urinary tract infections and find out why you're doing those things.
Yeah, no, by the way, cranberry juice, what's the value there?
The value is pretty extraordinary. When we get an infection in the bladder, some of those bacteria have a little appendage called a P. fimbria, and that P. fimbria can actually kind of stick itself like a burdock burr into the lining of the bladder so that no matter how much water you drink, you can't flush these bacteria out. The cranberry juice has an agent which causes the lining of the bladder to be too slippery for the bacteria to adhere to. If for some reason you don't like cranberry or it's too acidic for you, a very strong tea of hibiscus flowers will also do the very same thing.
Oh, by the way, I'm big on cranberry juice and cranberry grape. And I saturate myself with this stuff all the time.
Sounds really good to me. As we both know, grapes are some of the oldest healing foods on the planet, right up there with vinegar and honey as remedies that have been around, easily for 6,000 or 7,000 years. And again, Down There, Sexual and Reproductive Health, The Wise Woman Way, includes simple home remedies using things that you already have on hand. It's not, you know, some of the books on alternative medicine are so complicated. You read them and you think, well, that might be good for somebody, but not me. It's too hard for me. But I make things very, very simple for people. And I think that's why my books are so popular and successful, is that people come to me and they say, you know, the things in your books actually work. And I certainly don't take the credit for that. The Wise Woman Way is a way of healing. And it's a way of abundance. And it's about sharing information. And if you look, you know, at the acknowledgments page, at the enormous list of helpers and readers who've helped me with this book, there's over 100 of them. And so for each particular problem, I actually had people dealing with that problem who consulted with me after I had collected remedies and said, this one doesn't work, this one works. In order for this one to work, you have to do this. And so you're not just getting somebody's kind of intellectual knowledge, although it's certainly intellectual. There's 50 pages of footnotes, but you're getting experience from people and what really works in real life.
Let me hold you up because there was a question. We got about 2 minutes, and there's a personal question that I have here. What do you use to gain weight?
what do you use to gain weight?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you the thing that my teachers taught me, if someone needs to gain weight, is to drink beer, preferably a dark German beer, for breakfast.
Mm. Beer, huh?
Beer. Mm. Loaded with B vitamins, extremely healthy for you, and helps to increase the appetite. I know the very first person who ever told me anything about this was an elderly woman who sat down beside me in a park bench in Manhattan where I was sitting nursing my daughter. And I actually lost a lot of weight as I began to nurse, and I was even lighter than I had been as a teenager. And this woman, you know, noticed and sat down next to me, and she said, "Dear, in order to keep this baby healthy, you're going to have to gain some weight, and what you're going to need to do is to drink a dark German beer first thing every day." Now, of course, I thought she was a little, I don't know, maybe not all put together, it sounded.
Problem with beer and me? Alcohol. I just smell it, and I just have no tolerance. I'm going to be drunk all day.
I know. Ah, me too.
Susan,
absolutely. But if we're talking German beer, it is different. And I'll
have
to tell you that my apprentices and I brew a lot of herbal beers, like nettle beer, and herbal wines, like elderflower champagne. And I find that the alcohol in those reacts very differently in my body.
Susan, we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at so we can buy the books?
Please come and visit me at SusanWeed.com. Now, I keep the sun in Susan, but if you spell it Susan, you'll get there because we own both Susan Weed and Susan Weed. And if you want to buy any of my books, come to the Wise Woman Book Shop.com. And you can find out all about the many things that you mentioned, my workshops, my apprenticeships, my online learning, my correspondence courses, which happen through the mail, a lot of ways to study and interact and to find out more about the Wise Woman Way and about down there, sexual and reproductive health.
Wonderful. Hey, I want to thank you so much for being here. I've appreciated your time. I don't know about the German beer, if I can deal with it, but I'm certainly going to drink more cranberry juice.
There you go.
You get old, it happens to you. Okay. Hey, Susan, thank you so much for being here. Good night.
Good night. Green blessings.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long.
Oh, you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say, this bit, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after. They've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new.